choral music of Kaya Saariaho, Spring, performed by The Crossing, a chorus dedicated to the performance of contemporary choral compositions, conducted there by its music director and its founder, Donald Nally. Donald Nally's name, I'm sure, is familiar to you, WFMT listener, because you know him as the chorus master these last two seasons and continuing of the Lyric Opera of Chicago. And you've heard his work a great deal this season, and you've also heard him, I believe, on the radio and maybe on some of the intermission features and on the Operathon. But today he's our guest on Critical Thinking, talking about choral music, non-operatic choral music, and talking about contemporary choral music as demonstrated by the group that he founded and heads in Philadelphia, which is a town that he has spent a lot of time working in various aspects of opera and choral music. I'm Andrew Patner, your host and producer for this series. And in addition to welcoming you, I also wish to welcome Donald Nally. Welcome.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
Tell us a bit about the piece we just heard.
You know, Kaya has a very unique sound world. The emotional aspect of her music is completely inseparable from the sound color world. And she therefore has developed a language in which she uses, as you can hear, sort of manipulated electronic sounds. Some are synthesized, some are recorded, and then bent in various ways. That piece is spring from a piece called Taktasias, Day of the Years. And it's settings of Holderlin poem. She wrote this piece for her mother. It's settings of Holderlin poem. And these poems came from after Holderlin was in an asylum and was writing under a false name and had created kind of an alter persona for himself. And he wrote these almost sort of saccharine, in some ways, poems that are tinged with these. If you look underneath it of the irony of the words themselves, and you know who Holderlin is, this person who previously wrote all about, like, you know, life throwing you from rock to rock as you know sort of like wash your way through towards death, you know, tumble towards death, and then here he is writing, you know, about just the beauty of the landscape, and underneath there, there's this real sadness about these about these poems. And so I think it fits Saariaho really well because she's quite an intellect, and, you know, like, just her mind is it's just amazing. And I don't know if you know L'Amour de Loin, the piece that really made her famous at Salzburg, but and they've done that at Santa Fe, and they did this year, they did Adriana Mater, her newest opera, at Santa Fe as well. And it just, you know, in order to, and there's a lot of people in Santa Fe this summer who really didn't, I think, enjoy the piece all that much, because you have to sit down in a chair and prepare to just experience this oral situation, you know, this. I don't want to call it a bath because you really have to, you know, even bathing is active.
You have to be thrown from rock to rock without moving.
Yeah, you kind of just have to let it happen. And in this piece, as you can hear, you know, the music doesn't really develop. Mm-hmm. It's almost like you're walking. You're taking a walk, and, you know, as one does in taking a walk in the woods, and you pass a tree, and you pass a bush, and you pass another tree, and there's a different kind of shadow in that tree, and, you know, tall trees and the greens and the different browns and all that kind of stuff, and that's what you're experiencing as you walk through the piece.
We seem to be at a time in the early 21st century where people around the world find a great attraction to composers from way, way up in the dark, cold north, the whole fortunate revival of interest and in and performance of Sibelius, this interest growing perhaps out of some of the new agey stuff in Arvo Pärt's music, Saariaho coming from Finland, though based in Paris. But you can take Salem out of the country, but you can't take the country out of Salem in her case.
You're absolutely right in her case, yeah.
And we've seen here as well, I think Ravinia had the U.S. premiere of her flute concerto a couple of years ago. We see it, those who've been able to see the operas, and we hear it in her other music. But the thing that you're doing with your group is, in part, reminding people that great composers also write choral music in many cases, and that there are composers who specialize in choral music but who write on the same level of seriousness and depth, and because they also can use words, they can connect with some of the most important poetry or other lyrics past and current, and that you can present not only a concert but a series, a season, and a whole chorus that is dedicated to this music in the same way that another organization might be dedicated to music of our time for instrumental forces.
Yeah, the thing that I shouldn't say I find amazing, and partly don't find amazing, but I still have to say that it's quite wonderful and a bit of a surprise, is that we have this audience that keeps getting larger and larger. They have no idea who the composers are because we are constantly introducing new composers. We gave a concert on Sunday with some Erhard Kakashka, a new piece of David Shapiro. There was a piece of David Lang, who's our audience does know because he won the Pulitzer this year, and we've done quite a few pieces of his. A number of other composers' names that they wouldn't, there's no point in even advertising who they all, Paul Spicer.
It's not as if you put their names up on the poster and people are running
they're
going
to go, oh, yeah, you know, I love Brahms Requiem. Well, let's go hear that for the 17th time, you know. That's not the case, you know. So really they're coming because they really want to find out.
Mm-hmm. But this must be something that has built up over time. I mean, when you... What year did you start the group, and when you first opened, what was the audience expecting?
We had the advantage of the fact that I had lived in Philadelphia for 124 years or something. And
that makes me 125 because I noticed that I'm a year older than you are.
yeah, things were different back then. You know, and so I had conducted the Choral Arts Society, which is a large symphonic chorus. I had one of the major high Anglican churches right on Locust Street, right just a block from Curtis. And
so you had something of a following, general choral work and for being a church musician.
And I was the opera chorus master there.
Right.
So, you know,
and so you could say, hey, let me show you something else.
Yeah, basically. And also we had done with Choral Arts and with St. Mark's and with the group that I had called the Bridge Ensemble there in the 90s, we had done a lot of new music. And so the sort of transition was not a surprise. You know, I think everybody went, oh, okay, I guess this is what they're going to do now. And mm-hmm. So I wouldn't say it's necessarily that I had a following, but we had a following.
Right.
You know, the group, the St. Mark's Choir used to do a bunch of concerts. And on those concerts, we would the Howells would be probably the oldest composer that we would do, mm-hmm. and we'd do unknown Howells works. But mm-hmm. we did Judith Weir and her contemporaries, Gabriel Jackson and James McMillan. There was a lot of James McMillan. Mm-hmm. So the new incarnation wasn't a shock, I think, to anybody. And so I think we started out with a firm base, but we have definitely seen this consistent expansion over the last 3 years of new faces coming, and we've gotten much more. I think we've gotten much more adventuresome through that process.
I want to talk about the whole concept of adventuresome programming and how it actually does work with audiences in just a moment. But let's hear some more music. Why don't you tell us about Kyle Smith and the piece we're going to hear?
Well, Kyle Smith is like my group tends to have these unhealthy love affairs with the composers that they get involved with. And I think that we're all a little bit married to Kyle. Because Kyle, I wouldn't call him a sacred music composer, but there's definitely this connection that hits a vein with a lot of my singers, which is not to get into any kind of religious discussion, but to say that the organic spirituality, which is a part of really any great piece of music, regardless of what the topic is, runs very deep in Kyle and as a person, mm-hmm. and as a composer. And so Pífaro, the Renaissance band, which is, I think, a fairly well-known mm-hmm. group and has a bunch of recordings, they commissioned this piece, a setting of the basically a Renaissance Vesper service in German. Mm-hmm. And it has a few recognizable hymns. It's Epiphany Vesper. Sorry, I should have qualified that. Mm-hmm. So it has a few recognizable. Wie schön leuchtet Morgenstern, for example, is a very well-known hymn that we all sing. How brightly is the shines the morning star. Da, da, da. So that piece essentially opens the it and it has several other chorales in it, and there are some chorale arrangements for the instruments. It's an hour-long piece. It's a substantial commission, mm-hmm. And it was they came to us and asked us if we would collaborate on it, because I mean it's really a totally equal balanced instruments and chorus piece. At any rate, the first piece that Kyle wrote for this Epiphany Vespers, when he found out that it was going to be my group, was a 16-part motet on a Herr Christ, on another German hymn, and he just kind of like went, I've got these voices and I want to write this really huge textured piece. And the funny thing is that it's actually not all that difficult to sing. I mean, you have to have singers who can carry a part totally individually, but right. It's not atonal by any means or anything like that. So at any rate, we love this chorale that we're about to hear, because it does start out as a simple harmonized four-part chorale, and then it breaks into more parts, eight parts, and then it breaks into the 16 parts. And in a way, why I think it appeals to us so much is that it has it goes from this very substantial standard salt of our earth in choral music writing, you know, four-part non-imitative polyphony, you know, and to completely independent 16-part polyphony, imitative polyphony, mm-hmm. that then breaks out with sounds that hover above us and remind us that, you know, that we're looking up, that in Kyle's view of the world, all things eventually move up to a place that's better, and you can hear that in this music. It's really exciting, and it suits us perfectly because of these kinds of really crunchy harmonies and these kinds of floating sounds above.
Well, let's hear this experiment in contemporary polyphony of Kyle Smith with The Crossing, led by our guest, Donald Nally.
Thank you.
an excerpt from the modern, not modern, setting of a Renaissance Vespers for Epiphany, although we're not broadcasting it at that time. We are actually recording this in the Epiphanius week of the calendar, if you follow the Western calendar, work of Kyle Smith, a contemporary American composer who has worked closely with Donald Nally and his group, The Crossing, on music for some time. And we're talking about music written in our own time for chorus, sometimes written for use in churches or other settings, and sometimes written for the same reason that other composers write music, so that ideas can be heard in a musical setting and then in a musical environment. This side of Donald Nally, whom you may know and should know as chorus master of the Lyric Opera of Chicago, this side was known to me in writing, but really sunk in with me in December of 08, when Donald Nally presented with Sir Andrew Davis and Richard Hoskins, organist from St. Chrysostom's, the first ever choral and organ concert, the first ever choral concert by the Lyric Opera Chorus. It was called Holly and Ivy, and I had been intrigued when I first read about it because, one, we'd get to hear this great chorus in concert, and two, when I saw the program for it, I thought, wow, someone's going to actually put on a seasonal concert at Christmas time that does not have Santa Baby on it and that doesn't even have carols in the well-understood or commonly understood sense, but has music really written about and responding to the texts that are the basis of belief for many and of musical tradition for others. And then I went to the concert and at the Civic Opera House, which was packed. And I wasn't alone because I think nobody really knew quite what to expect. And everybody was blown away. There was a silence in the house that was a respectful and attentive silence. And even people who had brought little kids, and I guess the announcement had said, this is really a concert for kids 12 and older. Not that you were singing dirty songs, but you were doing heavy-duty stuff. But people, even at intermission, they went right back in with their little kids. It was a hypnotic setting all the way around. I don't want to call it a wake-up call because there are many fine groups here in Chicago that include or focus on modern works, but I think that a general audience that wasn't following a particular group or a particular conductor was shown this wonderful array of music that is out there now and what can be done with it even by choristers who don't specialize in this repertoire.
It was truly a gift for us to be able to do that. It really came about largely because of the structure of this season had Lulu and Porgy and Bess in it, and so our regular chorus, for the most part, didn't sing in either. So we had this time, and we were able to do that. And but the programming of it, of course, was really the issue. I mean, that's knowing that our audience is largely an opera audience, and hoping that we would also attract an audience of people who are choral music lovers and maybe aren't people who go to the opera and bring all those people together, but largely that, you know, it was a subscriber event and largely programmed with that in mind. So it was a challenge for me because I mean, when we've done Christmas concerts with The Crossing in Philadelphia, I think people come, you know, ready to put their seatbelts on because the first, the first Christmas concert we did opened with James McMillan's Santa Maria Moder Milde, which is just the sopranos and tenors kind of screaming up on the high E's going, Santa, you know. And in fact, I did it at Christmas Eve at St. Mark's once in this you can just close your eyes and think about what this sort of middle-aged Anglican man probably looked like when he came up to me afterward and said, well, I knew that childbirth was difficult, but I didn't think I would come to Christmas Eve and have to listen to it.
Oh, my.
And I happen to think it's a really beautiful piece. So at any rate, we really, and Andrew and I played. In fact, we had, you know, I spent a large part of the summer in New Mexico kind of just hiding and getting my re-energized. And I was totally out in the middle of nowhere talking to Andrew on the phone in Amsterdam. And we were kind of back and forth by the hour because we knew we had to nail this down. And we've been working on it a few months and needed to get the structure right. I think in the end, we did. I hope we did. You certainly think that we did. To make it an event in which people can hear this marvelous chorus do a much wider range than they are normally called on to do in the opera. I mean, even when we do use that range, you know, when we do sing, you know, for example, Dr. Atomic was a place where we had the opportunity to use a really, really huge range. It's not so noticeable. You know, it kind of goes by you, and if we're doing our job really well, you actually don't notice it all that much.
You're not supposed to stand out.
Yeah, right.
I mean, people may wait for certain things, the humming chorus in Butterfly, but they're off stage anyway.
I mean, you know, part of what we do is to glue the story together and, you know, make the seams work. Help the audience understand the emotional impact of this or that or, you know. So so this was a great opportunity. I think that really the chorus, we started out with a wide range of reactions to exactly what we were going to, why are we singing Finzi? What? You know, I didn't go to school for this. And I think we all wound up going like, wow, yay, Gerald Finzi, you know, and you know, some of them probably didn't know who Morten Larsen is. And, you know, of course, a choral lover. Knows very well who Morten Larsen is, that he probably built a house on each coast with that piece, you know, an apartment in New York, because that piece has sold zillions of copies and rightfully so. It's a very,
but it was new to these opera choristers,
a lot of them. Of course, some of them had sung it.
And I think that's a very important thing that all presenting groups need to bear in mind. What an audience wants, I think, having been a performer and having been a critic now for a reasonable length of time, an audience wants quality.
Mm-hmm.
If you do something extremely well and if you are fully invested in what you're doing, people will still have preferences. There will be people who will prefer Baroque music or prefer country and Western music or whatever. But there's always going to be a difference between something well done and something well written and something that isn't. And I think that when you give people something that challenges them but says, we worked on this and we're doing it well now, then a lot of the resistance drops away. And people then embrace it. And as you found with this group in Philadelphia, they subscribe for a whole season.
I think that that quality issue is, I mean, it's hard to talk about and sound without sounding unhumble, you know. But I think that quality issue is huge.
It's your chance to be unhumble.
Well, when people come to Lyric, they do have an idea of a certain standard. And those people that think that on the rare occasion we don't meet that standard, we hear from them, you know, and we should. Because they're listening. They're active listening. They're part of what we're doing and they're invested in it. Well, I find the same thing in Philadelphia is that, again, if you present all sorts of, I mean, we're going to hear later on a couple of pieces where if it wasn't done well, it would just sound just what, why, you know? Mm-hmm. And I've heard that, you know, I've heard people do a new piece or a piece of new music on a concert and not be able to find the sound for it.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of new music, the polyphony of it, because it relies so heavily on expressive harmonies and very close harmonies, it must be sung with a purer tone than say Verdi, you know. And if you approach it without that, then the piece isn't there. Mm-hmm. You're not hearing the piece. And so an audience then reacts and goes like, well, I don't like that music. I don't want to hear music of today if that's what it sounds like. But the truth is it doesn't sound like that.
So tell us about David Lang.
The thing I love about David is that his music is just pure honesty. And what I mean by that is, like, I don't mean it's just honest music. Mm-hmm. I mean it's also pure honesty. Mm-hmm. We just did a piece of his on Sunday from a larger piece that he had written for Trio Medievale, and it is about a 6-minute work, maybe a little bit longer, in which a 3-part women's chorus sings "I Want to Live Where You Live" over and over and over again. When you first look at it on the page, you kind of go like, whoa, what am I going to do with that? You know, I like the idea, but what am I going to do with that? And the answer to the question is absolutely nothing. Mm-hmm. Don't touch it, because he has found a way in his music through this, what I will call minimalism. You know, I mean, it is minimalism, but I think we throw that term around way too much. I mean, because there's so every single composer that writes minimalist music, I think, writes very individually. And so it's, you know, it's kind of like when we say romantic music, well, we know we're talking about this huge wide, you know, we're mm-hmm. talking about Brahms, or we're talking about Wagner, blah, blah, blah. But when we say minimalist music, we go like, oh, it sounds like Philip Glass. Well, no, it doesn't. Right. So David's music is really, really individual, and it's very, very, it's brought down to very fine, basic elements. But what he does is he admits to his own obsessions and ours. Mm-hmm. He admits to the grueling repetition of our minds, you know. Mm-hmm. There's this piece. Well, the piece that we're going to
hear. What is the piece we're going to hear?
The piece we're going to hear is called "I Lie." And it's this Yiddish poem about lying in bed waiting for one's lover to come, and the person who's singing, the person who's speaking, is talking about, you know, the night. He says the night has many hours, and only one of them is this, the hour that you will come. I mean, it's not that simple, but and in fact, we called the concert that this was on "The Night Has Many Hours," because there is this feeling in the piece of such calm waiting, this kind of sadness of having no choice but to just wait, you know, in the middle of, I don't know. I mean, I think we all probably have those nights in our memories, most of us in the 20s, in our 20s, you know. You give up on that after a while, but of this, just this endless, it seems like it will never come to a close. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the thing I love about it is that David just, he is so courageous.
Thank you.
I Lie, The Night Has Many Hours, David Lang, last year's winner of the Pulitzer Prize in Music, the composer of that choral work, performed for us by The Crossing, the Philadelphia-based contemporary composition chorale, founded and directed by our guest today, Donald Nally. There are 20 members in the group, as I understand it, and you can hear that not only do they blend and make a wonderful collective, but you have some fine individual voices in there as well.
In fact, at the end of that piece, you can hear Karen Blanchard singing the soprano. It's a very low soprano part, which she brings this amazing kind of world knowledge to. You know, she opens her mouth and you hear like history of the world in it. it's really great. But I have the incredible soprano section, which you can hear over, you know, in all of these pieces. I mean, the ability to for four people to come together and float.
The group is how old now?
We're 3 years old. Okay. Our first concert was in November of 2005, but then we didn't do anything again for a year because we had never intended to become a group.
Right. Tell us about the next piece we're going to hear.
We are going to hear a piece of Erhard Kakoschka. He is a really, he lives in, I'd really like to get to know him because, again, as you can tell, I'm totally fascinated by these people whose heart seems to live somewhere in their intellect. And they can't, and then it kind of falls out onto the paper. I imagine that in Karkashka's studio, he like opens his head out and sort of shakes it out.
Well, let's hear the movement that's going to give us a chance to think that we might make it from Karkashka's contemporary rethinking of the Lutheran chorale.
Thank you.
an excerpt, but not a bloody chunk. It has a nice frame on its own of Hart Karkaschka, Polish composer resident in Germany, The Crossing, and Donald Nally bringing us that excerpt from his rethinking, resetting contemporary response to Lutheran chorales of death. Donald Nally, it's been great talking with you, and this is actually going to be the first of at least three Donald Nally shows this year because you do so many different things, and I know that however much people have been enjoying our talking about your group and about these pieces, they are also wanting to know about the life of a chorus master. You've had a pretty considerable season already with Manon, the Pearlfishers, and then a basically from scratch full chorus, expanded chorus for Porgy and Bess, which was just a mega hit on top of everything else. And you have a few things coming up, very, very well, Butterfly Running as we're speaking, and you've got Tristan and Cavan Pag and Abduction from the Seraglio. So we're going to want to talk with you about that. And we're also going to want to focus in on one set of programs that you've been putting together, and that's musical settings, recent, new, and even commissioned of the poetry of Paul Celan, C-E-L-A-N. And we will be having you back for those other two hats that you where can you just very briefly, though, tell us about the piece that we're going to go out with?
Gabriel Jackson is a Bermudan composer who lives in London. And he has a very unique style. It's his own. It's conal. It's extremely compact. And it's a very clean sound. He writes almost all sacred music. In this piece, it's just a hymn text in an original setting. It's what I would call sort of easy listening a little bit, you know. But it has a surprise in the middle of it where the organ just explodes with joy, and then you return to the previous world of sort of calm reverence.
Well, Donald Nally is somebody who has calm reverence and explosions of joy. You hear it in his work, and I can tell you we see and hear it here in the studio with him. Thanks so much for joining us, and let's go out with Creator of the Stars at Night, Gabriel Jackson, perhaps the first Bermudan composer to be featured here on WFMT, certainly on today's program. I don't know what's more beautiful, that composition or that performance. Creator of the Stars at Night by Gabriel Jackson, Bermuda-born, London-based contemporary composer. The Crossing, the Philadelphia-based contemporary artist, found joined there by Scott Detra, organist of the National Cathedral in Washington, D.C. Founded and led by our guest today, Donald Nally, N-A-L-L-Y, who is also the chorus master of the Lyric Opera Chorus, the Lyric Opera of Chicago. We'd like to thank Donald Nally for coming in and bringing that music. Go to our website, WFMT.com/oneword, critical thinking, and you can get information on Donald Nally and The Crossing and the music that you heard today. Remember that that is where you can experience the Critical Thinking podcast, not only of this program, but of many of our other programs and of my Critics' Choice pieces as well. Speaking of computers, drop us a line. Let us know what you thought about this or any of our other shows. It's RENTAP, that's Patner spelled backwards, R-E-N-T-A-P at AOL.com. We'd like to thank Matt DeStefano for making this program sound great. We'd like to thank our funders, Alphawood Foundation and Draupner, LLC, a Chicago-based private equity firm. I'm Andrew Patner. We'll see you next week. You know how to do that. Yeah.